trying to convey this perspective of boundlessness, infinity, consciousness, just by the simple ability to pay attention. You know, just like listening, and but without listening for anything in particular. Because it is boundless and it contains everything, everything belongs, and then we can, from there, we have perspective on the particular details of this present moment, such as the body and the breath and the state of mind, the mood of the jitta. This unconditioned, then, is what I'm doing is I'm starting from this point, from the unconditioned. Then the conditions are in perspective. So I'm pointing to that because the more you think about it, the more confused you'll probably get, because it's not a point of thinking or figuring out, but in realization or recognition of it. So when I talk about sound of silence, and this is I found the most useful, skillful means of tuning in on that level of that boundless, unconditioned, where the conditions then can be seen in that perspective, the rising, ceasing. So this relationship of the conditioned to the unconditioned. Now, putting that in the context of the Four Noble Truths, because the Four Noble Truths is the essential teaching, then it's taking suffering, the ordinary experience of dukkha or suffering, recognizing that, or understanding it, investigating the causes of suffering, leads to the insight of letting go of the causes. So that's dealing with the conditioned realm. When you're the first two noble truths, the third noble truth then is the reality of the unconditioned. Or it's called the cessation, nirodha, of the conditions. So in being aware of where the world ceases, the conditions cease, is the way of recognizing the unconditioned, or the path, the Eightfold Path. So then the third noble truth, fourth noble truth, is the insight, the recognition, and the realization of cessation when everything ceases or when cessation takes place. You're aware of the ceasing of a thought, of a mood, of an emotion. So that's why it's not a matter of trying to get rid of them, or, you know, trying to, you know, suppress, deny, or resist conditions or emotional experience, but letting go of it, allowing it to be what it is, so that its natural cessation is recognized, and in that recognition, that realization of cessation is the same as the unconditioned. And then the development of the Eightfold Path, right understanding, samadhi, samasangapo, this right understanding, right intention. So there's this wisdom. The wisdom faculty is now operative. which leads to right speech, right action, right livelihood. In terms of the practical issues of survival, living in the society, within the human form, is to take us to a natural inclination towards non-violence, respect for nature, doing what is appropriate and skillful, compassionate action in the world, and then this also includes right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So this, what they call Eightfold Path, is really awareness, the bhavana. So the Third Noble Truth, the insight is realization of cessation, and then the insight into the Eightfold Path is developing this, cultivating, or bhavana. So this is what meditation is all about, cultivating, developing. And this also, in the terms that I'm referring to, is developing that confidence, that trust in awareness. Because even too much thinking about the Four Noble Truths is not the answer. It's putting them into practice, using them as tools for awareness, of investigation. Now this the Buddha encouraged, investigating, looking into, getting to the root of things. So in there's words like this in Pali that are, you know, encouragements to not just grasp Buddha's ideas or just expect, you know, wait for some kind of magic to happen, that, you know, a bolt from the blue that enlightens you, but to investigate, look into. The word vipassana, looking into the nature of things, insight. It's not intellectual knowledge, it's jnana dasana, insight. Knowing, much more deep and profound, is what they might call gut knowledge, realization. So one of the questions is about metta practice. And metta is translated usually as loving kindness in English. Unconditioned, put it into another, a more profound translation, is unconditioned love. So, unconditioned love. So, and what do we mean by love? Because this word is used for so many things in English. So, you know, this is where we need to clarify how we're going to use these terms, because so many words in English we think we understand because it's our native tongue. So we you know, I used to think I really understood English because it was my native language and then what I was first learned to use. And then I began to think, a lot of my thinking habits and use of English language is habitual. It's not even considered. You know, you just pick up a language and you use it and you think you understand the words, but sometimes the words I would use, I didn't really understand them in any profound way. I just assumed that I did. So then it's up to us, you know, when words are not absolutes, fixed entities with, you know, we have a choice of how we're going to use words and what we mean by the words we are using. We have to make it clear within ourselves if we're going to you know, try to communicate our experience to others. So when I use this term, unconditioned love, or metta, it doesn't have anything to do with liking anything. It's not like falling in love with somebody, or liking something. So sometimes we say we love something, which we really mean we like it. But it loves, I mean, you know, gives a little more emphasis. We like a lot. Now, the term love also, let's say, in the Christian sense of unconditioned love, is more how I would define metta. Loving kindness is all right too, but this unconditioned love is acceptance without any conditions. It's not saying I'll accept you and I'll love you if you behave yourself, or if you do what I say, or if you keep the rules properly and you do not offend me in any way, then I love you. That's conditioned love, isn't it? That means, you know, that if you don't do what I say, then I don't love you anymore. So that's what we call, I think modern, we call that emotional blackmail. And then the unconditioned love has nothing to do with liking or approving of anything. It's when you really trace and really aware of metta at its very source, it's unconditioned. Because metta practices are really using this attitude toward accepting everything as it is, including the devils, the angels, the good, the bad, the beautiful, the ugly, everything, the nasty bits, the corruption, the sublime. It's not the boring and so forth. It's unconditioned. So it's a relating to conditioned phenomena in all its aspects and permutations and variations without criticizing. It's a non-critical ability. So it's accepting and allowing everything to be what it is, unconditionally. Now it's I found in the emptiness of the mind, the non-attached emptiness of awareness, developing and cultivating this, then one is really in that state of unconditioned love, because it's a natural state of being that isn't personal. It's not mine in the sense of I have developed loving kindness or metta practice. I'm just filled with it as a person. It's beyond my personality. Personality also is a part of that. Not to criticize or oneself or one's personal habits, but receiving even the unpleasant, the dark, the bad side of one's psychic makeup with loving kindness. Applying that to oneself, we start with, may I abide in well-being. So this is starting with this being here, and then from there it radiates outward to all sentient beings. Then it really, and so it includes all sentient beings, the devils, the Lord of Death, everything. President Bush. Rumsfeld. And Tony Blair. Now, this does not mean approving or liking or agreeing. Because that we can't do. You know, some things are likable and some things are not. The nature, you know, conditioned phenomena is infinitely variable. It's refined and coarse, and you know, it changes and it varies, and what we like is dependent on conditions, and what we don't like. So these are changing. You know, you can't really like something that's unlikable. Just like say, somebody's being really nasty to you and very insulting, and you can't like them at that moment. You can't like that, but you can still love them, isn't it? It's metta, unconditioned love. So in one experiment I made years ago, I felt a lot of anger toward a particular monk, and kind of rage and indignation and anger. And so whenever this monk's name came into my consciousness, I'd feel this rage. And my personality is one that gets outraged. I can even get violent. So, you know, if I follow it. So, this has been a challenge for me, because when just the name of this particular person came into consciousness, and, oh, my fist would clench. So in metta practice, you know, you think, I have metta for this monk. I can't do it. It's easier to have metta for George Bush. Now, why was this? Because this monk is a good monk, too. It's not that he's an evil force in the universe. So I started making this conscious, my anger and my rage conscious. So I started writing it out in one of these notebooks with lines, and just writing out in each line my anger, resentment, rage. And I filled up about 3 pages of vitriolic, scurrilous language. I wasn't editing or trying to be politically correct in any way, and just let it flow out. But the intention was not, you know, to harm, but to make conscious this rage. So it's like having this metta acceptance of this emotion. You see what I mean? Just from the ideal level of having metta for somebody that only brought up rage. So it doesn't, you can't, you know, there's no way I could convince myself on that level of just sentimentality and idealism. I had to work it, I had to have the metta for the rage, for the anger. So I wrote it out quite intentionally and deliberately until I came to a point where nothing manifested. I bring this and then this person's name into consciousness, and there would be no rage. There's nothing. And I'd try, think, one more nasty thing to say about this person. I couldn't. It's completely, go on. Because in writing it out somehow, it did make it very conscious. And at that time, and then I accepted this. Rather, I wasn't trying to be the perfect monk filled with loving kindness towards all sentient beings. I was, when it's coming from the self view, when metta is merely sentimentality, isn't it nice to love everybody and be kind? It can be very superficial and not go very deep. So getting to the root of it, having metta for this anger, this rage, this nastiness in me, by accepting it, by writing it out, and not criticizing or feeling guilty or anything, but just writing it out in order to let it go. So this made the rage and anger very conscious, and then it reached a point where there's nothing more. And in that emptiness, in that where there was no more rage, nothing left, and the image of this monk came into consciousness, then there was love, metta, for this monk. So I thought, this is wonderful, you know, underlying all that bitterness and anger is love, you know. If I just looked at it superficially, I think it's impossible to have metta for this monk. Because on that level of thought and ideas, sentiments, if I hadn't accepted, I hadn't dealt with, I hadn't allowed this rage to be fully accepted in consciousness. And so then the having metta for this anger seemed to resolve the anger. It completely vanished. And then what's left when there's no more anger is metta. That's what I call, that's real unconditioned love. So just notice on the intellectual level, it's all ideals. We have this sense of how things should be. You know, we should be kind to everybody and have compassion a good monk should be unselfish, shouldn't get angry, should forgive, shouldn't hold grudges, shouldn't be jealous. A proper monk, a really good Buddhist monk, should be like this. And when they're not, then they're not good Buddhist monks, bad monks. So then we get, then how do we really feel? Now we're all quite developed on the ideal level. The United States is a very idealistic country. You know, so we're brought up to hold high-minded ideals. So this is not a problem. We all know how everything should be, don't we? We all know how Spirit Rock should be. and how Amaravati should be, and Theravada Buddhism should be. So that's not a problem. But then on the emotional level, the way it is, what's happening there? How do we really feel? Because, as I've been saying, the ideals are not sensitive. They're perfect, they're beautiful, but they're, in themselves, they don't feel anything. You know, they're unfeeling. When we attach to ideals, we become insensitive. We become critical of others, of ourselves, of the society, of the things that we love even. We become critical because we're always measuring the way things are with the ideal of how it should be. So in metta practice, where we're not coming from ideals anymore, but from the way things are. For example, the anger and rage towards this monk. That's not my ideal for being a monk. You know, my ideal is not to be angry, not to feel this rage towards anybody. That's the ideal. But the emotional reality of that moment was, this is what's happening. This is the feeling. So the name of this particular monk, this name comes into consciousness and this rage starts operating. Then, from my ideal position, I can say, I shouldn't feel this. I should forgive and understand and be kind, and the poor fellow, you know, he does have his problems, and I should be more understanding, and I can go on like that too, because I know how I should feel. But how I really feel is like this. And so that's what I was writing out on this, on these sheets of paper. Not the ideal, but trying to make fully conscious the actual, putting into words this anger and rage. Until it was quite a wonderful insight, until it was completely finished, because at that point, I couldn't actually conceive of anything more to write. It was a real insight. There was nothing more because it was completely resolved at that moment. And what was left was sound of silence, emptiness. And then I thought to myself, what does this silence say to this monk? What is this silence? If it could speak, what would it say? And it says, I love you. Simple as that. It's the only thing it knows how to say. Unconditionally. So this is an experiment just from my own attempts at understanding and developing metta practice. So in this term of unconditioned love, loving kindness, love in general, you know, this is quite a powerful word in the English language, even though it's used for all kinds of silly things as well. But it's not to be despised or ignored. It's to be, how do you want to, what do you really mean when you use that word? What does it really mean? Or can you decide how you want to use it? I feel I can. I can decide how I'm going to use words. And this is what I'm doing. So metta then is our ability to, to receive life in all its infinite varieties and extremities with this unconditioned acceptance, uncriticalness. It's discerning. It's not a kind of fuzzy feeling of just not noticing the badness or the nastiness of anything, but it's not making it into a problem. It's not dwelling on what's wrong or on what's evil or bad. It's not getting stuck into that and then operating from how horrible something is. So metta then is what is at the basis of consciousness. When we're fully aware and conscious, our nature is that. As human beings, we we are capable of unconditioned love, and then karuna, compassion for the suffering of all sentient beings, and mudita, the joy of the beauty of the world that we're living in, and the equanimity, upeka. So these are the Brahma Viharas, the fourth sublime states, that they come from the empty mind. They're not personal qualities that I can claim as some kind of personal ability I have. If I do that, don't believe it. I'm just filled with metta, karuna, mudita, upeka as a person. But if I let go of the person, the sakya ditti, then these are natural responses. These are spontaneous responses to particular situations. So they're called the pure abodes because they come from the purity of our consciousness, from consciousness itself. They're not tainted with me and mine and conditionality of any sort. They're spontaneous from that unconditioned reality. So that's why in meditation we're stepping out of the way, like Ajahn Sumedho steps out of the way and allows the free flow rather than always getting in the way, trying to interfere with the flow of consciousness. Like a personal, if I attach myself, if I operate from my personality and my cultural conditioning and my prejudices and habits and emotional habits and so forth, then I'm always interfering with life. And then me projecting and causing distorting reality in whatever I'm doing, whoever I'm with. So that's why it is difficult in relationships and in societies and families and so forth to get along with each other, because most people are coming from personal agendas and so they're in conflict with each other. And so we have to use, dominate somebody or threaten them or bully them or, blackmail them or, just what they call dysfunction habits of just trying to kind of ignore certain problems and survive, just survival in the society, in the family, in a relationship. We can just live on that level of just trying to survive in some way, because that's probably the best we can do on the personal level. But when we transcend the personal, then the personal is no longer the main issue. Our unity lies in our awareness rather than just having to agree all the time on the condition level. So this is, this is a development of the human consciousness. This is the potential we all have as human beings for realization, for enlightenment. This is why the human birth is highly regarded. In Thailand, for example, they often say, oh, being born as a human being is the best birth. It's highly valued. And when I first heard this, it's a curse. To me, my humanity was like being cursed with something. I thought it'd be nicer to be an animal. At least you don't have all this complexity of guilt and remorse and self-aversion. At least I didn't, I would assume. The dogs and cats don't have that. But in, you know, in being a complicated personality, it's, you know, life is difficult. And even though I have no great complaints in my life, it's, I've been quite fortunate in the fact that I've not been, you know, I don't feel I've been mistreated or abused or a victim of circumstances. I've had pretty good, pretty fortunate life, even on the worldly plane. But even with the best of worldly conditions, the suffering was still incredible. And why? Because of the ignorance. You know, the terrible ignorance and the conditioned habits that I'd acquired just led to endless confusion. Developing a critical mind that wouldn't stop criticizing everything and myself included. So the inner critic, you know, is a real tyrant. An inner tyrant is always, even when I was, you know, doing well, even when I would win prizes or receive accolades, the inner tyrant would say, "You don't really deserve it. You really, you know, somebody." It would never let me feel good about anything. Why is that? Why was the mind conditioned like that? What is it? It's some kind of a very relentless, tyrannical force. They go, psychology, they call it the superego. And of course it goes outward and it goes inward. And so by recognizing this, how, you know, the modern education is all about developing your critical faculties and comparing yourself with ideals. Or it's competitive, you're always competing with others. You know, you're brought up to compete, try to outrun or be better than somebody else. So this competitiveness, this idea of having ideals, you know, who can be the winner, who can win the prize, who is the most beautiful of them all, and all the rest, is part of the cultural package. And so then then we're always looking towards the best, the top, the peak, and then the realities of our life can seem pretty dreary, you know, when we see ourselves compared to the very best, one can only feel a failure or inadequate. So that's where the Vipassana practices was the kind of way of healing this problem in my own experience by reflecting on the way it is. Like I found in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, the thing I loved about living there with him was the acceptance of life as it is. You know, he wasn't trying to say, you know, his monastery was the best and that we are trying to be the best monks and the purest and all this. Sometimes, you know, I'd go and ask him about things I didn't think were all that proper and I could criticize, and he says, "Well, it's the way it is, isn't it?" Well, you know, you should always try to make it better. You know, you should always try to, when you see anything going wrong, you should stop it and clean it up, make it better. And our duty is to always go around policing the world and the monastery, you know, we're looking at any kind of, you know, that it's, what is this home security kind of mindset. We see any monk or any sign of degeneration, we chop it off immediately. But Nungpo Cha wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. And so, and I observed that, and I thought, I rather like that. Because it's not a peaceful state of mind to always be caught in this trying to hold everything together and keep everything according to how I think it should be. That is exhausting. And you'll never succeed. You'll have a nervous breakdown. Because life changes, and this is where a meditation is bringing attention to changingness rather than to glorifying the peak moments of the conditioned realm and saying that's how it should be. Life should be a peak, a continuous peak moment. Life should always be at its best. That's the utopian idealism, isn't it? Build the society into a perfect utopian society where everything is as it should be. That you can only do through idealizing it. But the realities of this planet, planetary life, sensory activity, is not ideal. It's not an ideal. It's the feeling, it's the nerves, it's the blood flowing, it's the pain, the pleasure, the way things move and change. This is what we're experiencing, and this is planetary life. This is a sense realm, is like this. So in reflecting on Dhamma, and Dhamma is not talking about the best, but about the way it is. Nibbana is not the best. You know, like in terms of it's some kind of ultimate thing. It put it in the terms of ordinary. Because Nibbana is usually, in modern English, used for the best, isn't it? When you talk about Nibbana, you say, they name, you know, implying that something is really the best, they can say it's a real Nibbana, you know. The Nibbana restaurant is the... You wouldn't call it ordinary food restaurant. You probably perfume, you know, they'll probably name some kind of fragrance, Nibbana. It'd probably be some extreme kind of scent. It wouldn't be just ordinary kind of scentless perfume. You could use distilled water, it'd be cheaper. So ordinariness then is you know, this is in awareness. Awareness isn't extreme. It's not like samadhi, not like jhanas, where you absorb into states that are extreme. So it's not that. It's not refined. You're going to an ultimate refined peak of condition, of absorption into a refined condition. So what is it then, here and now, in the way you are, whatever state of mind or physical condition you're experiencing this moment? And of course this is where the challenge we have is to awaken to the way it is. So we have this reflection on all conditions are impermanent. Sape sankhara anicca. So this is very much the first two noble truths, developing awareness around suffering and its causes. So in first two noble truths, the dukkha, the suffering, understanding it, having the insight, really recognizing, admitting, noticing, fully conscious of this unsatisfactoriness, and then the causes of it, the second noble truth, the three kinds of desire, attachment to those out of ignorance is the cause. So then the insight is to let go of the causes. So this is where sabbe sankharani cha is the guiding phrase. Then sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhamma is not self. So this change from sankhara in the sabbe sankhara to sabbe dhamma. So in sankhara always means phenomena or conditions. That which arises and ceases. Dhamma is the deathless. So the Dhamma, the Amata Dhamma, Anatta, there's no self, the self is in this sense, in the Buddhist sense of using the word self, is always aligned to the Sakyaditi. The identity that we have with the five khandhas that it goes on question for most people. So in investigating Dhamma, we've got these very skillful teachings of the Buddha to, it's a kind of language we're learning, an agreed vocabulary. This is what I find valuable in like Theravada Buddhism, because in English, it's we don't have it so clearly stated, and where in Theravada Buddhism and in Pali also, it's a dead language, a classical language. So it's not like a living language that changes over time. So it's kind of the actual vocabulary we're learning is not just to learn more. Kind of exotic words, but to it's holding the meaning and then to look for the reality that these words are pointing at. And it gives us a vocabulary for talking about enlightenment, about nibbana, about liberation, deathless, the way things are. But it is a convention in itself, so it's not to be clung to. It's for our use. It's our opportunity how to use this tool, this convention, for wisdom and awareness. Awareness and wisdom, sati and panya. So during this retreat, this is what I'm trying to encourage the use of this convention for investigating reality here and now, and the conditions that we find ourselves here at Spirit Rock, the way they are, the way you are at this moment, the way it is here, not trying to compare it with some other place. And if we do, then we see that, tendency to compare this place with some other. It's not what we're here for. We need to decide which is the best meditation center in the world. But this is the way it is here. And with monasteries, it's so easy to form opinions about, how monasteries should be. But I always encourage whatever monastery I'm in, I open to the way it is, rather than spend my time criticizing it, thinking if it's not like my monastery, thinking that there's something wrong with it. And if I do incline to that, I observe that. I'm not going to believe it and follow that kind of activity, because I know it doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't lead to liberation. Doesn't lead onward. So in where whatever monastery I'm in, you know, this is the way it is. I observe, I discern, I notice. I'm aware that, you know, if there's things I don't like about it, but I'm not indulging in liking or disliking. So then every place one can learn from, you know, from, you know, like traffic jams in Bangkok, in London. I suppose there's traffic jams in San Francisco. In Marin County, I'm sure there's traffic jams. The opportunity, like Bangkok, is famous for its traffic jams. So Thais ask me about price. I say, you've got a really good situation here in Bangkok because you get stalled in traffic for sometimes hours. Good chance to observe Dhamma. Listen to the sound of silence. I don't know whether they do or not, but but seeing things as opportunities rather than just being frustrated by obstructions and difficulties in the world that we experience. And so it's like learning to use the flow of your life, you know, any kind of illness, disease you have, or disabilities. These are not obstructions to enlightenment. These are, you know, unless you determine that they're going to be, then you're creating that into an obstruction. It's not an obstruction in itself. So sometimes we learn the, you know, the really difficult patches of my monastic life, where I've had to develop patience and endurance, and that have oftentimes been the most strengthening. You know, when one learns to endure and learn from adversity, the confidence and the strength that results from that. Now, in my own life as a monk, you know, just been through all kinds of ups and downs and good patches and bad patches, just like anyone else's life. But the confidence that I have now in the path is a result of that. You know, it's putting it to a test when everything's falling apart. When everything's going wrong in my life, and all my good efforts seem to have come to naught, and I'm being blamed and reviled, I really learn a lot from that. Because I'm willing to use that, you know, and then that, because I don't, you know, this is what I most dread. Personally, it's criticism and failure as a person. So when that sense of failure arises and I'm being criticized and blamed, this brings up strong emotion. And then I see that as a challenge, you know, as an opportunity for awareness. So in this practice of sound of silence, I can receive my anguish, despair, and anger. I can allow it to manifest and be what it is and let it go. And of course, all conditions that arise cease. So everything, the world ends, the conditions cease. And the result of that is peacefulness. Happiness that isn't dependent on things going my way and everything being what I like. It's not the kind of happiness that you have when you people praise you and obey you and do what you like. Because that kind of happiness is short-lived. It doesn't, you know, can't depend on it. So this you find in your, in within, you know, when they say, it's, you know, the stillness within, the still, that unshakable, the, what they call a, akupa jeta vimuti, unshakable deliverance of the heart. This is the whole purpose of the holy life. This is what we're here for, to recognize, realize this akupa jeta vimuti, the unshakable deliverance of the heart. So that unshakableness is through sati sampajanya. Not through thinking. Thinking makes you shake. The more you think, the more you worry. And so if you're just caught in the wandering mind and the thinking mind, then you're shaking all the time. Doubting, uncertain, worried, anxious about this and that, about the future. But as you no longer abide in that shakingness and that thinking and identity with the five khandhas, then you find your strength in the awareness, because that awareness is unshakable. Once you cultivate it, it is always the refuge that is available at any time, whatever's happening, in whatever state you find yourself in. In terms of like great despair, several times in the monastic life, of feeling great despair with myself in the monastic life, where you feel a sense of being disillusioned and disappointed, despairing, and then with that, by recognizing that and trusting in the awareness of it, but you have to determine, determine to develop this, to cultivate this in daily life. So in this is what, so that's why I see these as opportunities or challenges for cultivation. So misfortunes of life present opportunities for us to cultivate, as well as ordinary life. Sometimes just the humdrum life of everyday life can really be boring, and we can get very perfunctory and just heedless because of the ordinariness of our lives. So it takes this determination to really observe this just mechanical living, habitual living that we do. We can easily just get caught in just following the momentum of habit. And then the successes, the peak moments, also, rather than just indulging in the pleasure of being a winner or that, being aware of that. So one isn't living one's life for peak moments. And when one is experiencing peak moments, one is not trying to hold on to them anymore. So they are what they are, and they cease. And we can appreciate the peak moment without attaching to it, without demanding that we hold on to it or recreate it. So that's enough for this evening for reflection.